Welcome to the new episode of American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, and lore of America's past. The show is hosted and produced by Cody Beck and written and performed by Troy Taylor. That's me. And we are now in our fourth season, Haunted New Orleans. If you're tuning into the podcast for the first time, we suggest you start listening to the Haunted New Orleans season with episode 53, which is where this season begins and where we set the stage for the many dark tales ahead. In each episode of the season, we'll be revealing the history, mystery, spirits, scandals, and sins of New Orleans, a city we believe is the most haunted in America. So lock all the doors, put away the knives, and if anyone knocks, whatever you do, don't let them in. New Orleans is a city that was literally born in sin. From the original charters that were based on fraud to the emptying of the French prisons to provide settlers to the region, there was widespread government corruption, gaudy social functions, rampant prostitution, and frequent lapses in any civilized moral code. There's no question that New Orleans has a long and very colorful history of crime and vice. The corruption began during the days of French rule and continued while the city was controlled by Spain. Vice flourished during the 3 years between 1800 and 1803, and then the city was neither French nor Spanish, and when a general sense of freedom allowed and encouraged the arrival of vagabonds and adventurers from all parts of the world. In the end, it would be as property of the United States, though, that New Orleans would embark upon its golden age of crime, murder, and spectacular wickedness, when it would achieve its status as America's leading city of sin. As New Orleans grew into a great American city in the middle 19th century, crime of every description began to increase. With money and wealth flowing into the city, the underworld grew richer and more powerful. During the 20 years before the Civil War, and for an even longer period after, the newspapers were constantly filled with reports of robberies, assaults, and murders. The New Orleans correspondent for the New York Tribune wrote in January 1855, quote, "Murders here are an everyday occurrence, and the papers daily give details of the same. 1,000 murders might be committed in New Orleans, and if the murderers could not be found on the spot, our authorities would never afterward make any effort to have them punished." The city, the reporter said, was suffering under a, quote, "reign of terror." By the late 1850s, it was reported that inquests were held for as many as 2 murder victims each week, and that it was common knowledge that at least 2/3 of the homicides committed in the underworld districts were never reported to the police, and the bodies of the victims, well, they were just never found. In 1861, the criminal sheriff of the Orleans Parish was quoted as saying that the place was, quote, "a perfect hell on earth," and that nothing could put an end to the murders, manslaughters, and deadly assaults till it was made penal to carry arms. No permit was required for the possession of firearms in those days, and men of all classes habitually carried weapons to protect their lives and property. Criminals and ruffians had turned New Orleans into what the sheriff colorfully described as, quote, "hell on earth." Outlaws and lawbreakers found refuge in scores of cheap taverns, dance houses, bordellos, and concert saloons, which infested the French Quarter and the area above Canal Street. Probably no other city in the United States was home to as many unsavory resorts in proportion to its number of citizens. On St. Charles Avenue alone, between Canal Street and Lafayette Square, there were 45 places where liquor was sold, and nearly all of them were disreputable. Similar congestions of underworld spots appeared in other places, notably along Gallatin Street in the French Quarter and on Gouraud Street in the American section. Even in neighborhoods where grocery stores outnumbered taverns, the store still managed to sell more whiskey than food. And where there is whiskey and women, there's murder. And where there's murder, well, ghosts and hauntings are sure to follow. Undoubtedly, the most startling stories of ghosts and crime in New Orleans came from within the walls of the old Carrollton Jail. In 1898 and 1899, there were so many stories told about the place being haunted that there seems to be little doubt that something very strange was recurring in the building. To make matters even more credible, the majority of the witnesses who experienced these bizarre events were hard-boiled, no-nonsense officers of the law. Their testimonies to the events in question make the eerie tales all the more chilling. This old structure, built around 1850, was officially known as the Jefferson Parish Prison, but more commonly was simply called the Carrollton Jail. Carrollton itself had come into existence around 1833 when a man named Charles Zimple laid out the town about 5 miles from the boundary of New Orleans. Zimple dubbed the new city Carrollton after General William Carroll, a hero of the Battle of New Orleans. He had been encamped on the site of the future town with an army of Tennessee volunteers while awaiting orders from Andrew Jackson. 2 years later, the New Orleans and Carrollton Railroad was constructed to connect the city and the small town. The railroad is actually still used today as the St. Charles Avenue streetcar line. It's the oldest continually operating line of public transportation in America, and everyone who visits New Orleans owes it to themselves to at least once take a trip on one of the famous streetcars. Well, the town grew rapidly, and by 1841, it was officially incorporated. Later in 1852, it was named the county seat of Jefferson Parish, and a city hall and courthouse were built. They remain standing to this day, even though New Orleans eventually annexed the city in 1874. One part of the administrative buildings was the parish prison. It stood on the corner of Hampson and Short Streets and served as a jail until it was demolished in 1937. The brick building stood 2 stories tall and boasted large doorways and heavily barred windows. Most called it a, quote, bleak and hideous place. And it was said that many of the inmates that were imprisoned here never left. Suicides were apparently quite frequent, and disease and the lack of medical care added to the death toll. Violence, as with any prison, was also common. Still more of the prisoners had their fates decided on the gallows that were located in the central courtyard. Many convicted thieves, rapists, and murderers met justice at the end of the rope after being imprisoned in the narrow stone cells of the jail. One lynching even took place in the courtyard after outraged citizens captured 2 men who had raped and butchered a little girl in the area. These violent deaths and terrible events created a haunting at the Carrollton Jail, a haunting that became a matter of public and official record. More than 50 years after the building was erected, the ghostly happenings of the jail became so persistent that they gained the attention of the newspapers of the day. On October 9, 1899, the first detailed reports about the supernatural in the parish prison appeared in print. At that time, the prison was under the authority of Sergeant William Clifton, the police commander of the district. He had served with distinction for many years with the New Orleans Police Department and had taken over command of the jail in 1898. He was well respected and admired by those who served under him, which included a clerk, a deputy, 2 doormen, and 8 patrolmen. One summer evening, 2 men and a woman stopped by the jail to chat with Clifton. They came in through the front entrance to the prison, which opened into a wide hallway. On the left side of the entryway was a door that opened into Sergeant Clifton's office. It was a sparsely furnished room with a desk, a washstand, a sofa, and a few chairs. Behind Clifton's office, with a narrow passage between them, was the clerk's office. In this room were more desks and chairs and a wooden railing that divided the office in 2. As the woman who accompanied the men leaned against a wall in the office, she was immediately shoved out of the room as though someone had struck her violently. She spun into the hallway and was sent sprawling onto the floor. Her eyes were wide with shock and she cried out, "Something pushed me! It pushed my shoulder away from the wall!" Clifton and the other men laughed, and one of them made a joke about her getting old. A little angry about the fact they didn't believe her, she leaned against the wall again. In seconds, she was sent reeling into the center of the room. Her body was flung into the group of men who were standing there, and she was forced to take hold of them to keep from falling down. This time, her face was pale with fear. She didn't care whether the others laughed or not. She was convinced that something was in the wall. Well, each of the men, including Sergeant Clifton, took turns leaning against the same spot on the wall. To their surprise, each of them was shoved away from it and toward the center of the office. They carefully examined both sides of the wall but could find nothing to explain the strange event. Clifton couldn't imagine what would be causing this strange effect, but then he remembered a story that one of his men had told him. It was about an incident that occurred several years before, prior to his taking over command of the prison. A murderer who had been charged with killing his wife and boiling her body in lye to make soap from her corpse. Some imagination. He was charged with killing his wife and was brought to the jail. According to the story, a number of angry police officers beat the man to death in the hallway outside what was now Clifton's office, and his body was left exactly at the spot where the strange effect was occurring with the wall. Could this man's ghost somehow be causing this to happen? Clifton dismissed this idea as nonsense, convinced there must be a logical explanation for what was taking place. However, events that followed caused him to think differently. A day or so later, Clifton was in his office with Corporal Perez, one of the patrolmen for the district. Their conversation turned to the portrait of General Beauregard that Clifton had hanging on his wall. He had always expressed admiration for the general, and in the course of the discussion, he turned to the portrait and gave it a quick, almost comical salute. Immediately, with a great crash, the picture fell to the floor. At the same time, the washstand with its bowl and pitcher jumped forward and turned over. Well, strangely, nothing was broken, including the glass in the frame. Even stranger, the heavy cord by which the portrait was hung was found to be in perfect condition. The nail in the wall was solid and even slanted upward. The two men, after close examination, could find no reason for the portrait to have fallen. Well, the following night, Clifton and Perez were telling some of the other officers about the odd happening. As he demonstrated what had occurred, he saluted the portrait once again. As soon as he did, the mirror that hung just below the general's picture flew off the wall. It also smashed into the wooden washstand, knocking everything to the floor. This time, the wash basin shattered into dozens of pieces, but everything else remained intact. Clifton examined the mirror hanger and found it to be as strong as the one holding the portrait. He later reported, quote, "It seemed as though invisible ears had been listening and that unseen hands pushed the things from the wall. I know that the portrait and the mirror could not have fallen unaided." Well, several nights later, Clifton was sitting at his desk when he was suddenly grabbed by the shoulders and his chair was spun completely around. At first, he thought it was one of his men playing a joke, but when he turned to confront them, he found no one there. The room was fully lit and he could find no one in the room or in the hallway. He questioned the doorman, who replied that no one had come in the door. Well, the sofa in Clifton's office was frequently used by patrolmen as a place to catch up on much-needed sleep during long shifts. One night, Officer Dell, who drove the patrol wagon, came in for a short nap. He no sooner stretched himself out on the sofa before it lurched forward and away from the wall. The bulky piece of furniture slid about 3 feet and then suddenly reversed direction and thudded against the wall again. This was the same wall where the man had been beaten to death and where the strange effect occurred that shoved the woman, Clifton, and the other men to the floor. Well, not long after that, another officer tried to rest on the couch. This time, it not only slid out into the room, but it also tilted sharply and bounced the officer off in such a way that he collided with the corner of Clifton's desk and gashed his head open. Hearing his cry, Clifton rushed to his aid and arrived just in time to see the couch sliding back up against the wall. The next night, another policeman, who made it clear he didn't believe in ghosts, lay down on the couch in the presence of a number of other officers. Suddenly, the couch tipped up and the patrolman fell onto the floor. After that, the men began to avoid the couch until someone moved it to another part of the room. At that point, the couch was again considered safe, but the patrolman avoided that particular wall of the office for quite some time. In October of that same year, a mounted officer named Jules Acoin came into Sergeant Clifton's office to make a report. Clifton had stepped out for a few moments and Jules stood waiting for him near the desk. He saw a flash of movement out of the corner of his eye and looked up quickly at a large lithograph portrait of Admiral Dewey, a Spanish-American war hero, that had been pasted on the wall. The same wall that had been the cause of so much strange activity in the office. Before his eyes, he saw the portrait begin to spin like a wheel. It was as though someone had placed a nail through the center of the picture and then started rotating it, an act that would have been impossible since it was plastered to the wall with glue. Well, Jules was stunned for a moment, and then he ran out of the quarter and began shouting for his fellow officers. Those who were nearby came on the run, including Sergeant Clifton. As the men hurried into the office, they saw that the portrait had stopped moving and was, in fact, stuck to the wall again just as it had been. Jules explained what he'd seen in the other men, having already witnessed odd events for themselves. Well, they had no reason to doubt him. In time, it began to be realized that the spirit of the wife killer was not the only ghost who haunted the prison. All the men who were stationed there reported weird and unexplainable noises, furniture and small objects moving about by themselves and falling without assistance, lights that turned on and off, and much more. It's not surprising that these bizarre happenings tended to keep everyone on edge. Requests for transfers to other precincts were frequently filed by officers who were stationed at the Carrollton Jail. One night in the autumn of 1899, Corporal Harry Hyatt heard footsteps in a nearby hallway. He stepped to the door of Clifton's office and looked around. Although he could still hear the sound of someone walking, he looked both ways up and down the corridor, but saw there was no one there. Well, the footsteps continued to sound, and Hyatt noticed there was something odd about them. It seemed that each solid step was accompanied by another step that dragged, as though taken by a man who was lame. Hyatt also noticed the corridor seemed to be filled with a faint smell of cigar smoke. Finally, he left the doorway and walked to the front entrance area of the building. He asked the doorman, Officer Foster, if he'd seen anyone come in. Well, he shook his head until Hyatt described the sound he'd heard in the hall. Well, Foster grinned at his friend and suggested, hey, maybe it was Harvey come back. Well, Harvey Brewer, a gambler and former prisoner at the jail, had been a gigantic man who walked with a severe limp. This impairment did not stop him, though, from killing two racehorse jockeys by breaking their necks with his bare hands. He also cut the tongues out of their horses. Apparently, he'd wagered a small fortune betting on both of them and was, well, angry when they lost. Harvey had been brought to the jail and had been last seen standing in the corridor in handcuffs with the cold stump of a cigar clenched between his teeth. Well, he escaped soon after and was never captured. His escape from the jail left two dead guards and a mystery behind. Well, when Hyatt heard this from his friend Foster, he shook his head and said, nope, he won't come back to see the inside of this jail again. Well, that evening, Hyatt picked up an evening newspaper and found a story about a gigantic man named Robert Brewer, who had been found dead in a Pennsylvania town. He had been blind and lame, but made a small living selling newspapers. After his death, they found a packet of papers among his effects that showed that his real name was, you guessed it, Harvey Brewer. The news story stated he was wanted in New Orleans for four murders and elsewhere for other crimes. That was when Harry Hyatt realized that perhaps Harvey had come back to the old prison after all. Well, the following night at the same time, Hyatt again heard the shambling footsteps in the hallway. They plodded back and forth, back and forth. Well, Hyatt went to the door when there was still no one to be seen, and he later recalled that he muttered out loud to the empty corridor, quote, okay, Harvey, you can stop your pacing and smoke your cigar now. Well, the footsteps suddenly stopped. From out of thin air, Hyatt swore, a great cloud of tobacco smoke appeared about 3 feet away. It swirled and then slowly lifted off toward the ceiling and disappeared. On other occasions, iron paperweights were raised from desks and flung at officers. Icy cold chills appeared without explanation, and always there were the ghostly footsteps. Not Harvey's shuffling limp, but others that walked throughout the building. They paced the corridors, they went up and down the stairs, and one of the places especially affected by the sounds was the second floor courtroom. That room had been refurbished from a row of condemned cells that had once been located there. In these cages were kept the men who would soon die on the gallows. One night, very late, the footsteps became unusually loud and several officers followed them upstairs and into the courtroom. The room was eerie and silent, except for the tapping of the phantom boots. They circled the room as the police officer stood back and listened. Then the footsteps stopped abruptly and the docket book, which was thick and weighed many pounds, flew from the judge's desk and crashed to the floor with such force that Sergeant Clifton heard it from downstairs. Well, the footsteps were heard no more that night, but Clifton had another encounter of his own that must have left him questioning the wisdom of remaining in command of the prison. In the early morning hours, he was seated at his desk when he suddenly felt the grip of strong hands around his throat. He could feel the air being crushed out of him, and he threw his arms up to ward off the attacker, but his hands struck nothing, but when he waved his arms, the attack immediately stopped. Clifton whirled around in his chair, but there was no one behind him. No living person had entered his office, and yet the marks of the hands could clearly be seen on his neck. In fact, the bruises remained visible for some days after. Well, one afternoon, two young girls appeared outside the sergeant's office and were spotted by Officer Foster. Since the sergeant wasn't in, he went over to speak to them. As he got close, they vanished before his eyes. Officers believed they were the ghosts of two young women who had been imprisoned there for carving out the liver of their shared lover. Yikes. On another occasion, Foster also reported seeing a former prison officer named Sergeant Shoemaker standing alone in Clifton's office. The man stood near the desk for a moment, then bowed his head and walked slowly away. He got to within a foot of the sofa and then he disappeared. At the time of the sighting, Sergeant Shoemaker had been dead for over a year. Stories and reports from the prisoners testified to the fact that officials were not the only ones to be bothered by the ghosts at the jail. Cell number 3 became notorious for the weird events that occurred inside of it. One night, a prisoner named Charles Marquez was brought in. All the other cells were full, so he was placed in number 3. The next morning, guards found Marquez lying on the floor of his cell, unable to stand and scarcely able to speak. His face was a mass of cuts and bruises, and he looked as though he'd been badly beaten. Well, Clifton first assumed that one of the officers had worked the man over, which, you know, really would not have been unusual in those days. But Marquez, once his wounds were treated, quickly convinced him otherwise. He claimed that he'd been beaten by unseen hands, that he'd been punched, kicked, and pushed against the wall. He never saw his assailants, and he never accused the prison's officers of giving him his beating. Well, other prisoners got their own taste of cell number 3. Every criminal who was put into it had the same tale to tell the next day, and all of them had bruises and cuts to show that their claims were apparently true. No one outside the cell ever heard a thing, yet the occupant was always in rough shape the next morning and usually babbling about ghosts and monsters. It was later discovered that many years before, on a night when the prison was very crowded, 3 murderers were placed in cell number 3 together. According to the story, they fought all night, each man punching, biting, and kicking the others. In the morning, 2 of them were dead, and the 3rd died before a priest could be called for him. Prison officials began to believe that perhaps one or all of these men's ghosts had remained behind in the jail. In 1937, the Carrollton Jail was finally torn down. Through its long life, the prison has been the scene of many ghostly tales. Legend even had it when the workmen demolished the structure, human shapes writhed in the clouds of dust, as though the creatures that had haunted the place now reveled in its destruction. Boy, this is New Orleans. For years afterward, people in the area also claimed to hear the spectral sound of the gallows trap as it opened and sent another condemned man to his death. And there are some older residents of the area that claim the sounds of the gallows can still be heard today. If I had to choose a favorite story of murder, mutilation, and ghosts from New Orleans history, it would undoubtedly be the story of the Sultan's Palace. It's a story that has a little bit of everything. Sex, pirates, foreign intrigue, blood pouring into the street, hacked off limbs, brutal revenge, and, well, did I mention sex? Anyway, it's a great story, and the mansion has long been known as one of the French Quarter's most imposing buildings and has played a starring role on the list of the city's legends and mysteries. As I said, it's a great story, but, well, as we sometimes find, New Orleans never lets the truth get in the way of a good story. A dentist named Dr. Joseph Gardet built the house at the corner of Orleans and Dauphine Street in the French Quarter in 1836. It was then one of the tallest buildings in the city. A few years after it was completed, the house was sold to a wealthy Creole man named Jean-Baptiste Lepre. He made the house even more extravagant by adding the cast iron grillwork to the balconies, which has since become the mansion's most distinguishing feature. With its top floor ballroom and spacious galleries, the house came to be regarded as one of the most luxurious mansions in New Orleans. Not surprisingly, it became the center of Creole culture in the French Quarter in the middle 1800s. Unfortunately, the wealth and power of many of the Creole families started to decline in the second half of the century, leading many to scandal and ruin. Lepre was one of those who lost most of his fortune, and he found that he was forced to rent out his beautiful home in 1878. His tenant was a mysterious Turk who claimed to be a deposed sultan of some distant land. A short time before, a vessel of war had arrived in New Orleans harbor at night. Men came and went from the ship on official business, and finally, a wealthy Asian man dressed in regal costume came ashore and was received with great respect by the city officials. Lepre was called into a private conference and was asked if his property might be available for lease. He agreed to the generous terms offered, not realizing the danger he was bringing to the mansion. According to what he could learn, the Sultan was not actually the deposed ruler of some distant Asian country, but the brother of the ruler. It seemed that the Sultan had fled the land with his brother's favorite wife. He'd hidden away in Europe for a time and then had sailed for New Orleans. He'd brought with him his entire entourage, including armed guards and a harem of more than a dozen women of all ages and descriptions. Well, Lepre had to take his wife and children along with all of their belongings and vacate the house completely. They went to live on their plantation while the Sultan went about transforming the house into an Eastern pleasure palace. The Turk had transported with him a fortune in gold and established a line of credit at all the banks. He used his wealth to begin work on the mansion. Soon the floors were covered with carpets from Persia. Soft couches were embroidered with colorful patterns. Cushions were piled high in the corners, and intricately carved furniture, chairs, and chests were picked up from the docks. Soon the move was complete, and the candles were lit, and the braziers were heated to warm the rooms. The smell of heavy incense and opium filled the air, and passersby could hear the laughter of the women and their soft voices as they walked in the courtyard each day. According to one writer, quote, "Their foreign tongues tantalized the neighborhood men, as did the rustle of their rare silk garments." And yet no one ever saw these beautiful women. Complete privacy was maintained at all times. The doors and windows were covered and blocked. The gated front portal was never opened, and men patrolled the grounds with curved daggers in their belts. The iron gates around the property were chained and locked, and the grand mansion had become a fortress. Well, neighbors began to talk, their curiosity aroused by the strange and forbidding changes to the house. A few weeks before, the place had been open and filled with light, but now it was dark and menacing. Well, they wouldn't have much time to ponder these changes, though, for terrible and bloody events were soon to take place. A few months passed, and one night a terrible storm crashed over the city. Under the cover of darkness, an unfamiliar ship with a strange crescent banner sailed into the harbor. In the morning, it was gone, and the storm had gone with it. That morning, neighbors passing by the mansion noticed that trickles of blood were running out from under the iron gates. The authorities were summoned but could raise no one, so they forced open the doors and went inside. They found the gate to the courtyard standing wide open on its hinges and muddy footprints leading in and out of the house. The officers and the neighborhood curiosity seekers got the first hint at the horror that awaited them inside the house when they stumbled over the bloody corpses of three servants who had been slashed with swords and left for dead in the courtyard. They cautiously entered the house and found absolute carnage. A massacre had occurred at the mansion. Blood spattered the floors and walls. Headless bodies and amputated limbs were scattered about, all of them butchered by sword or axe. No room was without a horrific scene. The bodies and limbs were flung about, mutilated and burned in such a way it was impossible to tell which body part belonged to which person. No exact count of the dead was ever determined, and the horror didn't stop with murder. The beautiful harem girls, the sultan's children, and even the guards had been raped and subjected to vile sexual assaults. The scandal was so horrendous that the details of that night have still not been completely chronicled to this day. The sultan's mutilated body was found in the garden where he had been buried alive. In his struggle to free himself from the ground, he managed to partially tear himself from the grave, but it wasn't enough. He choked to death on mouthfuls of dirt. Over his hasty grave, a letter had been left bearing an inscription in Arabic that read, quote, "The justice of heaven is satisfied, and the date tree shall grow on the traitor's tomb." It is said that a tall tree did indeed grow on this spot and was known locally as the Tree of Death. While the tree has long ago perished, the legends of the house remain. The identity of the murders was never discovered. Some say they were members of some pirate's crew who had business with the mysterious sultan, while others say the murders were the work of the Turk's brother seeking revenge for the theft of his wife and his family wealth. Well, we'll never know for sure who committed the horrible murders at the sultan's palace because honestly, we don't even know if those murders took place. Oh man. The first mention I could find about the murder of a mysterious sultan in New Orleans comes from an 1867 book by Charles Garry called The History of Louisiana. It mentions the house and the sultan who was a, quote, "great personage of the Ottoman Empire," but the only murder mentioned was that of the sultan himself, who was killed after a ship appeared that was filled with, and I love this quote, "a body of men who wore the scowling appearance of malefactors and ministers of blood," which would make a great band name, by the way. The story also appears in the 1922 book Legends of Louisiana by Helen Pritkin Schertz. It's basically the same story, but this time the intruders kill more people. The milkman is credited with first seeing the blood and going inside to find the sultan on a couch with his head cut off and five dead harem girls. Well, the story became part of the bloody lore of New Orleans, but want to guess where it never appeared? In the newspapers. or in the police records. The story was never officially recorded anywhere. Now, does that mean it didn't happen? Well, I don't know. It obviously got started somehow, but how much of it is truth and how much is legend? Well, we're never going to know for sure. But even if the sensational tales of the Sultan's Palace don't line up perfectly with history, there is one thing we do know. Tales of a haunting in the mansion have been reported for more than a century and a half. For many years, the mansion was almost a slum dwelling, as the owners did little to maintain the place. It was rented out as apartments for a time, and during the great influx of Italian immigrants in the late 1800s, it was during this period of its worst decay that an Italian woman who lived there made a living washing clothes. She would always hang them out to dry on the top gallery. One day, she fell over the ironwork to the pavement below and was instantly killed. Now, she most likely leaned back too far while hanging the clothes on the line, but other tenants in the building blamed the spirits for her death. She was pushed, they claimed. In 1949, the building housed the New Orleans Academy of Art for a brief time, but the whispers of ghosts and hauntings never really stopped. The story said that strange sounds could often be heard there at night, like soft music from flutes and the tap of footsteps on the stairs. It's also believed that the faces of women in the Sultan's harem could sometimes be seen peering out the windows on the upper floor. Screams, moans, and frantic running sounds were also commonly reported. By the 1950s, the house was once again an apartment building. It was divided into 9 units, several of which were two-storied. And still, the stories of ghosts continued. In a newspaper interview, one tenant of the house stated that she had been startled numerous times by a man in a garish oriental costume. The tenant, Virgie Poston, rented the downstairs front apartment. "I didn't know about the legend or even that the place was supposed to be haunted," recalled Poston, who later became a successful dancer and choreographer in the United States and internationally. And she added, "I was just starting out in my career and the cheap rent appealed to me." Well, she soon learned that strange things were occurring in the building. One day, the man in the robe suddenly appeared in her apartment. She vividly recalled the incident. "My two-room apartment had only one door, which opened into the main hall, only a few yards from the foot of an enormous central staircase that wound its way up to the floors above. I always kept it locked, and even if whoever had had a key, I think I would have at least heard it turning in the lock. Yet there was nothing, only silence. One minute he was there, the next he was gone. He didn't seem hostile, he just stood there and looked at me, but it was terribly eerie and nerve-wracking." Poston saw the man a second time a short time later. She woke up and he was standing at the end of her bed. And she said, "There was no sign of him when I turned on the lights and got up to check, but I abandoned everything there the next day and went to stay temporarily with a girlfriend until I could find another place to live." A few days later, she had her last and most terrifying experience. She and her girlfriend stopped by the apartment to get some of her things. She remembered what happened next. "We were standing in the dimly lit hallway in the empty house as I locked the door, when we suddenly heard a blood-curdling scream come out of the inky blackness somewhere at the top of the staircase just a few feet from us. It was petrifying, a long, shrill scream that ended in a horrible gurgle. We ran as if the devil himself were after us to the street door. For a moment, we even got wedged in the doorway as both of us tried to get out at the same time. We laugh about it today, but it was pretty frightening at the moment. The very next day, I got my things out of there." In 1966, the house was purchased by Jean D'Amico and her husband Frank and a partner, Anthony Vesage Jr. The house was in bad shape and desperately needed repairs. They decided to restore the mansion and convert it into luxury apartments. Soon after, neighbors began to tell Jean about the house's bizarre history and the bloody incidents that had taken place there. Jean D'Amico recalled, "People would look a little curiously at us whenever they knew we were the owners. Some even told me how they used to cross the street and pass it on the other side." However, she dismissed the stories as nothing more than supernatural gossip until she experienced something there for herself. One night while trying to sleep, Jean sensed a presence in the room with her. She looked up and saw a man standing at the end of the bed. "Thinking my eyes were playing tricks on me, I closed them for a moment and then opened them again to refocus, but the figure was still there. When the form suddenly began to move toward my side of the bed, I panicked and turned on the light on my night table. Imagine my surprise when there was no one there. My husband laughed at me when I told him, but I know I saw somebody." Even today, the Sultan's Palace remains a curious and intriguing mystery of New Orleans and the French Quarter. It's now owned by Nina Nevins, and it's divided into 6 apartments. When the building went up for sale, she Googled it and saw that it was, quote, "a harem of horror," as she called it, but she fell in love with the house and knew she wanted to own it. She since decided that she doesn't believe all the stories about the Sultan and the murders, but does admit there are some odd occurrences in the place. She says the strangest thing is when keys to the apartments go missing and simply don't show up again. She added, "It's weird, but I never feel alone in the building." Well, maybe it's an early not so weird. We may never know all the secrets of the Sultan's palace, but the stories will always be there. Are they too good to be true? Perhaps. But who knows what this place might say if these crumbling walls could talk.
There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about, and that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book. And they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself and I sent it to my mom, and she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do, so I'm really glad to have this. And I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother too. So check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today.
Good to go?
Yep, I'm ready.
All right. Thanks for tuning into the American Hauntings podcast, the show where we discuss history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. We are now in the middle of season four of the podcast, Haunted New Orleans. I'm your co-host, Cody Beck, and with me is my co-host, author, historian, crime buff, and the founder of American Hauntings, Troy Taylor.
Hey, getting almost really past the middle.
I almost now changed
it. I know. I thought about that. Well, we kept saying deep into, and then right. We changed it to middle, and now I'm thinking that we need to change it to... You know, less episodes than I have fingers on one hand because we're getting toward the end.
It's a little wordy, but you're an author. I think you could yeah. figure it out.
Yeah, and that might not necessarily be accurate. You know how I am.
Yeah, so I don't.
This was actually
going to
be a much longer episode than it was, and then I decided, well, we better split these up some more.
So. Yeah, for all I know, we might like have to go back and be like, we're not even in the middle of the season yet, because you'll change your mind and flip the script on me.
Do something different.
Dude, we are recording. In person again
this week
for the
yeah.
first time in
yeah.
months.
And next week probably won't be, but that's okay.
Yeah,
you know, at least we got a chance to do it, and then it won't be long, and we'll be able to start doing it more often.
Yep.
So
yeah, it's
yeah.
nice to see everybody again.
Yeah,
it's been so long.
I know.
When was the last time we actually saw each other?
It was the. Did we record the last weekend before the? Yeah, I think we recorded the weekend right before the lockdown. I was in town. I had a dinner on Friday night and a tour on Saturday, and I think we recorded that weekend.
Okay, was that when we were like finishing our like backlog of stuff? I'm like, oh, we're banking these for months.
Yeah, and because we did.
We lucked out.
We didn't. It was halfway through the pandemic
before
we said, oh, and by the way, this is the first time we're recording one since all this started. And that was way into it.
Yeah. So, and we just did not acknowledge that, like, hey, we recorded this 2 months ago. So any jokes we make about, you know, anything is just disregard that.
Right.
So, 2020, it sucks. The world's weird, but things are starting to come back around.
Yes.
We're still trying to figure out how to deal. What do you got coming up?
Well, we have been dealing things as, you know, I was talking to some people last night, you know, things are starting to open up, but not so much for us here in Illinois yet. We moved a phase, which means we can kind of get together a little bit. We can eat outside, you know, which I think
phase,
we could have
Mom.
Done anyway, but anyway. We really can't start doing anything again live in person until we get to what's called phase four here, which won't be till the end of June.
Just like the MCU. So,
yeah, it is getting to be that way, isn't it? So, yeah. So anyway, we've put together a couple of, I mean, don't get me wrong. We're July and August, we're going to be back rolling again. And we do have some events that are not filled already in July and August, which we're really looking forward to more than I ever thought we would be looking forward to any events ever again.
Right.
But we do have some stuff in July and August. And, if you're listening to this the week this comes out, keep an eye on my Facebook page, because if you think that you might like to attend something in July and August, there may just be a promo code
that you may be able
to find on there. So keep that in mind. That'll be coming up the week that this the show airs. So
nice. That's facebook.com/authorTT.
Yeah.
Check it out.
And I think most people probably find or know that page.
Sure.
I think, because we've been doing all those Friday night quarantine things. But we're also going to be doing, and because we all can't get right out and get back together and do events again, we're going to do a couple of private Zoom sessions on June 13th and June 20th. And those are going to be private ticketed events. It's only $13. And we don't care if it's you that sign up and everyone in your house watches it. Doesn't matter to us. But we're going to be giving out private links to that Zoom session. It'll be a limited number of people. And I'm going to be doing on the 13th, I'm going to be doing a live stream with the Bell Witch.
Nice.
The dinner that we do, except, you know, adapted for a live stream audience. And then we're going to be doing the spirit world, which would be spiritualism and seances and Ouija boards and all that stuff. And that'll be on the 20th. So that stuff is posted. We just posted it on Friday, this past Friday. And they're starting to fill up. So if you're interested in doing that, just go to AmericanHauntings.net. And you will find not only that, but you'll find the events that we have coming up and stuff. But like I said, watch as far as the July and August events, keep an eye out on the website, because we're going to be doing some sales stuff on that, you know, because we've been doing that since the pandemic started. We started that promo code spooky thing where people could get the free tote bags. We have been through, Lisa, how many would you say? I mean, hundreds of tote bags.
Nice.
So it's been nice. It's been great. People have been really great because, I mean, you know, little guys like us, no one is helping us.
Right.
You know, except for our people, our friends, you know, our customers have been really great during this whole thing. So it's been really cool. So we are going to continue that at least until the lockdown comes to an end. And I'm sure we'll come up with something new. But we also have one more new thing that we announced last week. And I thought this was the perfect place to talk about it.
Okay.
Because this is where the name came from during our season of the Villisca and the X-Man.
Yep.
We came up with the Morbid Curious. We started talking about that. And we said, we got to use this name for something. We have to do it. And this was like about a year ago. And I said, I think I told you off the podcast, I said, you know, I think it'd be a great name for, well, it'd be a great name for a band, but it'd also be a great name for like a magazine or something. And we should really think about doing something
like that. I said, what's a magazine?
I know, right? No. But we decided that a year later, we finally decided to pull the trigger on this thing. So,
yeah, tell me all about this.
Yeah, well, it's going to be, it won't be like a glossy, like, you know, People Magazine or Entertainment Weekly. It'll be more like a journal, which means it's going to be a different size, kind of thin, like a book.
Yeah.
And we're going to do it twice a year. And it's going to be contributed by whoever, listeners, friends, other authors, conference speakers, whoever. You know, we're going to be, I've had a lot of interest already of people getting in touch with me, telling me, oh, I'd love to do an article for this. And it's, you know, it's going to be a journal. It's going to be ghosts, hauntings, true crime, anything historical, the dark side of American history.
Yeah.
Essentially, it's essentially the format of the podcast, but it's going to be a journal to go along with it. So we're going to do it two times a year. We are looking for some writers. We've had a lot of interest from a lot of people talking about it. In fact, I've even gotten an article already in like the first 4 days.
We've already
gotten something. So, but we will be looking for writers. So if that's something that you would be interested in, go to the website, AmericanHauntings.net. You'll find the image there for the Morbid Curious. And we will be working on our first issue. The deadline for articles on that will be August 1st. And then that will make it so that we can put out a fall issue for the autumnal equinox. And then we'll do one in the spring also. That's our plan.
Nice.
So any of those things that you're interested in, the occult, the unexplained, whatever, we're interested in looking at your stuff. So anyway, there you go.
Awesome. Do you have like designs and stuff already? Like you working on that in the back end or?
Yeah, we'll start putting it together. I'm still thinking about, I'm in the middle of yet another quarantine project.
Okay.
So great. I'm wrapping that up and but I have been putting it in the back of my head as far as, you know, how we want it to look and that kind of thing. So we'll keep it fairly consistent, but I mean, if you like the designs of our books, it's going to be that same kind of thing. It'll be similar to that, but more of a journal form.
Got it. Awesome. Well, I'm excited. I'm going to submit a bunch of stories under different names and then just see if you like any of them and be like, yeah, to see how many times I get rejected. Okay. Well, I mean, speaking of, you know, user generated content, let's talk about listener reviews here. We got some great reviews even in quarantine, and I want to give some shout outs real quick. So this first one comes to us from Bernie Campos. It says, hi guys, I've been waiting till I was caught up before submitting my review and subsequent 5-star rating. Thank you. I found your podcast last fall and have been slowly binge listening. Yes, I realize that's contradictory, but I listen at work or I can at times for several hours and then not for days. I live in central Illinois, a little north of Champaign, so I enjoy being able to relate to places such as Alton, Blue Island, etc. I love how easy you both make it look to blend history, legend, humor, wit, and spookiness. Each season is better than the last, with the New Orleans season my favorite. You've brought to life, pun intended, a part of the great city that I was unaware existed. Loving the partnership of history and hauntings. Troy, your research is meticulous. Cody, your insight's spot on. Keep up the good work. Looking forward to more. So thank you for that review. And this next one is from Insanden 88. I don't know. I can never tell with these names, but I love it. So one of the best. As an over-the-road truck driver, I have a lot of time to dive into podcasts. As soon as I listened to the first episode, I was hooked and proceeded to binge every episode available. Troy and Cody have provided me with many entertaining hours on the road, except for that one episode where one of them put down a coffee mug on the table and the sound made me think that one of my tires had exploded. Thanks, guys, for the great content. Can't wait to see what's in store for the future. I put that one in there, I mean, because it's nice, but I guarantee you it was some kind of alcohol and we put it down on the table and weren't thinking. Yeah, so thank you for that review. And then I got another one here. It's just from JCP Nicole 13. It says, I stopped watching television years ago and tend to read or listen to podcasts and books on tape. I'm pleasantly surprised with how much I enjoyed this podcast. History and supernatural mixed into one makes us feel like educational and entertaining at the same time. Keep up the hard, good work. So thank you very much for that. And then, Troy, you have something.
Yeah, I've got one too. And it was sent just direct via email. And I'm just going to say it's from Heather P. because she may not, I don't know if she wants me to use her last name.
Okay.
But it said, hello, Troy and Cody and Lisa too, of course. Says, a couple of weeks ago, I had a brainstorm that I wanted to take a weekend getaway trip to New Orleans for my 40th birthday in September. And then I remembered your podcast was just beginning its New Orleans season when I fell off the podcast wagon several months ago. So now I've caught up on the podcast in less than 3 days, which has resulted in multiple pages of notes, airline tickets purchased, and a reservation at the Hotel Villa Convento, mentioned in the Haunted Hotels episode, along with an ever-expanding list of many places to revisit, memories from our honeymoon trip in 2003, and basically every location you've mentioned this season. I've loved the American Hauntings podcast from the beginning. Troy's monologues and the resulting banter with Cody in the discussion portion make for excellent blend of education and entertainment. And since stumbling across the podcast, I've taken a Haunted Alton tour, a Ghosts of the River Road tour, attended the Evening with Lizzie Borden dinner last year, and also attended the Haunted America conference. Not to mention the multiple books I've purchased. I've also ordered Troy's New Orleans books, One Must Be Prepared After All, because I just had to know more. You could say I've become a bit of an addict. But there's a reason I keep coming back to learn more. The research is unparalleled, and Troy demonstrates an absolute passion for the topics he discusses in each and every episode. Listening to the New Orleans season has reminded me of how much I love visiting 17 years ago and how much I want to go back and experience all that again, this time with more knowledge of the incredible city. Now that I've layered on the flattery, all of it deserved, I wonder if you've considered listing and linking the locations you've mentioned and your own favorite spots in the cities you've discussed. An American Hauntings travel guide, if you will. That would be an amazing resource for the people who love to check out the weird and fascinating places you talk about and want the good food and drinks, too. Thanks for your excellent podcast. Look forward to whatever you guys decide to tackle next.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. So that's why I wanted to run that by you, because it was a pretty cool idea.
Yeah. Well, where better to do it than on air, right? The whole email is very flattering and very kind. And it's a great idea. I mean, you could probably figure something like that out. I mean, mm-hmm. pretty easily, and roll it into something else.
Yeah, we could just make a list with links to those places, the hotels that we mentioned in the episodes and all that stuff. Probably wouldn't be that hard.
Yeah, I try to do some of that stuff in the show notes, but not mm-hmm. like
but
that
can't
extensive.
Do everything. But maybe we could do everything. We could just add it in just for each episode.
Yeah.
You know, the hotels, or just put a link to the hotel.
Yeah.
You know, or the bar or whatever.
Well, you know, that's interesting because when I was in the early days of Lore, when I was listening to that, I started kind of mapping out a little bit. It's like, oh, if he was talking a lot about Pacific Northwest stuff, and I was like, this would be a very interesting thing to do a tour based off of his podcast, some mm-hmm. of these different places. But somebody's going to visit the Midwest or New Orleans or something like that, or even Villisca, or wants to ride the Villisca, the Axe Murder train kind of thing. You know, we can map some of that stuff out and link to things that could be interesting.
Yeah.
Well, let's revisit this.
Okay, we'll do.
Later on. Are you ready to dive in?
Sure. Yeah, I'm ready.
I wanted to start off. Can you tell me a little bit about, can you just give me and other people an update? What is the Dead Men Tell No Tales series? You have a lot of things about this.
Yeah, that's a series of books that I have written, and it's a combination of ghosts and crime,
mm-hmm.
And not every one of the books necessarily is a ghost story.
Yeah,
some of them are just historical crime, but for the most part, there is some kind of ghost story involved in each one of those books, or at least something supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't remember off the top of my head how many books are in that series.
A lot.
Now it's like 15 or 16, I think. But I just, those are my two passions, historical crime and ghosts connected and hooked together. And so I put together a series of books on that. And so I thought, well, we'll just call that this section of the podcast, you know, Dead Men Do Tell Tales Part 1, Part 2, however many parts they're going to be on this.
Right.
One,
so. Got it. Okay. Yeah. I knew that was kind of a running trend, and I wanted to just clear the air and see.
It's a whole series of books. So
awesome. Yeah. Okay. Well, how it relates to this story. So you've mentioned it a thousand times, but New Orleans is a city that was built on sin. We've said it before. We'll say it again. Yeah. I didn't mean for that to rhyme, but it did. In the end, it would be as property as the United States that New Orleans would embark upon its golden age of crime,
murder.
The
first murder. Section of this was as seen previously on.
Yes, you know, exactly.
It was just a quick reminder.
Sure. You know. Then you said in 1855, reporters said that the city was suffering under a reign of terror. And you had a couple quotes here I want to read. So by the late 1850s, it was reported that inquests were held for as many as two murdered persons each week, and that it was common knowledge that at least two-thirds of the homicides committed in the underworld districts were never reported to the police, and the bodies of the victims were never found. And you said in 1861...
to the alligators.
Right?
Yeah.
You said in 1861, the criminal sheriff of Orleans Parish was quoted as saying that the place was a, quote, perfect hell on earth, and that, quote, nothing could put an end to the murders, manslaughters, and deadly assaults till it was made penal to carry arms. So it sounds like a great place.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, so anybody could carry a firearm without a permit,
sure.
Which is great.
Well, that's why they tried to do that, you know, in a lot of Western towns. They would, you know, you had to turn in your guns at the sheriff's office or at the livery stable before you could go out drinking.
Uh-huh.
Because it's the only way they could keep you from killing each other.
Right.
And this probably could have benefited from something like that. And,
yeah.
But it was just too hard to do. It was just too big of a place, and there were just too many taverns and dance halls and bordellos, and you know, there's just too much.
And let's get into that. So you said on St. Charles Avenue alone, between Canal Street and Lafayette Square, there were 45 places where liquor was sold. Nearly all of them were distributable. This makes me think that like Grafton could have been so cool
right.
with all the saloons, the
right.
Bloody Bucket, and
sure.
I can't remember how many bars or saloons you said they had back then.
They had like 26, and that in, you know, you're talking about a tiny little stretch of street, a lot less than this.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
Still on the river, man. It could have been, what could have been.
Yeah, it would have been interesting, that's for sure.
And,
so.
And this is a quote from your writing that I actually text somebody today because I said, this is like my new favorite thing. It says, and where there is whiskey and women, there is murder. And where there is murder, well, ghosts and hauntings are sure to follow. I love that. Whiskey and women, murder, great. So let's talk about the Carrollton Jail. So it seems like just right off the bat, what we're going to talk about in the story, like there's a lot of like poltergeisty type activity, mm-hmm. like really interactive
right,
kind of
right.
hauntings and things, which is something that we talk about every now and then, but we don't see as often, I feel like. So that's why this episode in particular has me really excited. So it was built around 1850, officially known as Jefferson Parish Prison, but named for General William Carroll, as that was a town laid out about 5 miles from the boundary of New Orleans. And then in 1835, the New Orleans and Carrollton Railroad was constructed to connect that city and the small town. Today, you said it's used as the St. Charles Ave streetcar line, and it's the oldest continually operating line of public transit in America.
Yeah, it runs just down St. Charles Avenue all the way down to, you know, along Canal.
Mm-hmm.
Down to the riverfront, and you can hop on it and you get a pass all day, and it's cool. It's just really cool to do it.
So you had me walking around that whole city time.
We could have hopped on. Well, but then it goes clear up to like, you know, to the other parts of the city.
Right.
We were mostly in the French Quarter when we were there. So,
no, that's fair. I enjoyed the walking, except when it would just randomly rain.
Yeah, that's normal.
Humid,
summer,
miserable, but it was great. So the town's officially incorporated in 1841 and then annexed in 1874. Let's talk about this prison a little bit. You said many who stayed in the prison never left for a variety of reasons. So suicide was common, disease, violence, hangings, even a lynching. So talk about traumatic history. I mean, this place checks off all the boxes,
all the boxes
and more.
Most jails do. That's
yeah.
why you find so many haunted jails and prisons, because, you know, you have a constant, everything that causes a place to be haunted, a jail has like all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
All the time in one concentrated area. So it's no surprise that, you know, jails and police stations become so haunted. It's just not common that, well, not anymore anyway, that you hear about them or read about them in the newspapers mm-hmm. being haunted. But, you know, it's funny, this was right around the turn of the last century where this made all the newspapers. And, you know, they were telling these stories in print, and these guys were actually admitting that the place was haunted,
yeah.
and they were quick to speak about it. I've collected a lot of stuff like from Chicago, and it's from early 1900s where, you know, all these haunted police stations and jails, including the old Cook County Jail that was downtown, you know, was extremely haunted.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was more than willing to admit to the fact that it was haunted. You just don't run into that so much today.
I was going
to
ask, know? Like, that's maybe not, like in Florida or something,
yeah, it's just
like,
not
but
common.
It's not in the newspapers,
no,
at
it's
least.
It's just not common.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think that, you know,
it's taboo. Or?
Yeah, I think we've entered a different, you know, it's a completely different time, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's just not as commonly accepted. I mean, you can go back through old newspapers and from the 1890s through, I don't know, 1915, 1920, well, really up until World War I. And you'll find ghost stories in just about, I mean, at least once a week, there'll be ghost stories in major city newspapers. When I was working on the new edition of Haunted St. Louis a couple of years ago, I found tons and tons of ghost stories, all from the newspaper.
Yeah.
You know, and because it was common to report this stuff. And sometimes it would be very tongue-in-cheek. And,
sure.
But other times it wasn't. They were dead serious. And that's what you got with the Carrollton Jail. They were completely serious about the things that were going on there. They weren't joking about it. They really, officers were transferring out to other precincts. They didn't want to work there anymore after they got a little taste of the stuff that was happening.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting to me because, I mean, you think about, like, the tabloids and things and shit that they just completely make up now. It's like about celebrities and stuff like that. Like, why wouldn't they just talk about, you know, this some of these hauntings and things? Why is this any more bizarre? I guess I see some, like, alien stuff in there every now and then, but yeah. Ghosts, not so much. But so back to this prison. So the prison's under the authority of Sergeant William Clifton, the police commander of the district. And on October 9th, 1899, the first detailed reports about the supernatural in the Paris appear in print. Let's talk about this, what I'm calling a haunted wall.
Yeah, I don't know what else to call it. See, that's another case of where this story is just printed verbatim in the paper, and nobody tries to make any sense out of it at right. all. Because, I mean, let's be honest, we're talking about a haunted wall, which they think has something to do with a guy who had murdered his wife and then tried to make soap out of her body.
Very Fight Club-y, yeah.
And then supposedly he was beaten to death there at that wall, which is just something, well, that was just something he happened to remember that had happened a few years ago. We don't even know if that's the case.
Sure.
But, and so then people start getting pushed away from the wall, knocked down, knocked onto the floor and stuff. And I just thought, that's the first thing they came up with is, oh, there must be a ghost in the wall.
Yeah.
But when you hear the whole story, I guess it makes sense, but I've never heard of anything like that before.
Yeah. Well, I liked, you tell the story and it's very like, I don't know, it's not even out of a movie because I'm sure this just happens in real life, but it's very much like, oh, the woman's the one that, like, sees the ghost and gets pushed and all the guys are laughing at her. And then she's like, all right, well, you step up and do it. And then they all do. And then they all get thrown too. And it's like, yeah, okay. It's not just like in her head, you know, like this is something that's actually happened. I actually put in my notes, it's like Clifton remembered a story about a man who killed his wife and boiled her body to make soap. I put a note in here because I listened to you and I was like, don't just gloss over that part. What are you talking
I know,
about?
Right?
Like, that's so fucking bizarre. But anyway, so.
But then you go, well, it's New Orleans.
Well, yeah, it's, you know.
I think I even say that a couple of times in the story. Well,
you do.
Yeah, it is New Orleans.
You do. So just shrug. Yeah.
Gotta expect it.
So we think that they might have had the wrong ghost because a day or so later, Clifton salutes a picture of General Beauregard, if you remember from our previous episodes, that he had hanging on his wall, and that picture immediately comes crashing down. No one could find an explanation for how it fell because everything seemed to be intact. Decides to recreate the event the next night, and then a mirror flies off his wall. Like, dude, you got to stop saluting shit.
Yeah,
like,
right,
everything in your place is going to be broken. several nights later, Clifton's sitting at his desk, and he's suddenly held by the shoulders, and his chair spun completely around. Now, that's kind of fun.
That is.
That seems like a little kid kind of ghost
prank
thing.
Until it chokes him.
Yes, yeah. And that does happen. And I like how he has a sofa in his office. An officer tries to take a nap. Sofa lurches forward from the wall and back to the wall. Then it happens again.
And then we just glossed over the fact that a guy keeps a couch in his office because these guys sleep on duty.
Yeah, that's a good point.
We just kind of skip over that part, or they did anyway.
That is a good point.
When they were reporting the story, so.
Yeah, well, you know, you're pulling all-nighters.
Yeah, I guess.
But, so it happens again and again. And then you say they finally moved the couch.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you can't figure out any other way to stop it. Let's just move it to a different wall.
I like it. There's an officer named Jules Alcoin who saw a painting of Admiral Dewey spinning as if it had like a nail in the center. But so this sounds to me like something out of like a Ghostbusters movie.
No, it was I think it was a paper or something they'd torn out of like a Harper's Weekly or something, newspaper kind of magazine. And then somebody glued it on the wall just to, you know, hanging up pictures.
Okay.
But which makes even less sense.
Yeah.
Because he said it was spinning on the wall.
Yeah.
Even though it was glued to the wall.
It's bizarre.
When he calls somebody to come and look at it, like, look at this. I swear to God, it was just spinning. Of course, they believe him because
all the other
they've
crazy
been trying
shit.
To sleep in there and the couch kept throwing them on the floor. But it doesn't even make sense that it was spinning, but yet he swore that it was.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
It's a little bizarre stories.
It
so
is.
This and other events, like you said, cause a bunch of officers like, okay, can I get a transfer?
Yeah.
Like the F out of here. Let's talk a little bit about Harvey Comeback. I guess that's the Harvey Comeback. So Harvey Brewer, gambler, former prisoner, was a gigantic man who walked with a severe limp. Said this impairment did not stop him from killing two racecourse jockeys by breaking their necks with his bare hands and then cutting out the tongues of their horses. This makes, for some reason, it makes me think of like Carl Panzram or something.
Or
I know
the Sopranos.
I see. I haven't watched The Sopranos, and I get shit for it all the time. But now I'm kind of curious.
The horse lost a lot of money. Let's burn down the barn. Fuck it.
Oh, what, okay. That's the thing that happens. So that's what that makes me think of. But so Harvey been brought. I want you to clear something up in a minute because I got a little confused. So Harvey been brought to the jail. Last seen standing in the corridor in handcuffs with a cold stump of cigar. He escaped soon after. Was never captured. His escape left two dead guards and a mystery behind. So what's up with this Robert Brewer guy?
When he was running. Okay, so he is Robert Brewer. He used, it was a fake, because they never, he disappeared. He killed two of the guards and he escaped.
Right.
And then that was kind of the joke when they talked about him, you know, hearing limping footsteps. Well, you know, maybe it's Harvey come back. And then he says, oh no, he'll never see the inside of this jail again. Well, it turned out that at the same time this had happened, in Pennsylvania, there had been this big old guy who had, you know, was down on his luck, that was selling newspapers and had gone blind, and then he died. He was found dead on the street.
Okay.
So when they looked in his effects, they found papers that showed that his name wasn't Robert Brewer, it was Harvey Brewer.
Got it.
He was the guy missing from New Orleans, and the night that he died was the night they started to hear those limping footsteps in the station, and then, you know, he has that encounter with the cloud of tobacco smoke.
So, yes.
Harvey's ghost came back to the Carrollton jail.
Okay, so my thinking was, no, this man is still alive, and physically be walking around the jail.
No,
That's why he got confused.
He's using a fake name.
Got it.
And then the police in Pennsylvania realized that it was him.
Okay, that makes way more sense.
Okay.
Moving on to the next section that I just titled More Shenanigans. The second floor courtroom had been refurbished, so it used to house condemned men. Officers at one point follow footsteps up to a room where a docket book, which you say is large and heavy.
Yeah, it just keeps track of what trials are. At the time, everything was handwritten.
Right, so that flies across from the judge's desk. At one point, Clifton woke up at his desk feeling strong hands, like you mentioned, gripping his throat from an unknown source, but it left bruises on his neck, which seems like very different
that
from a lot of stories. Yeah, because I mean, that's just a whole other kind of level of like poltergeisty type shit. And then Officer Foster spots two young girls, went to speak with them, and they vanished before his eyes. And hold on. He believes that they were the ghosts of two young women who had been imprisoned there for carving out the liver of their shared lover.
That is all the information I could find about them. Although I believe they were, I believe the original description, it was two mulatto girls.
Thank you for leaving that out.
Yeah, I just left that out. But that's the only other information I could find about them. I don't know anything about that case.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have found out more about it, but I couldn't find anything.
Yeah, so. Well, I just wanted to say
it was one of those things mentioned in passing.
Yeah. If I
get, it's New Orleans, it's normal.
It's New Orleans.
They turned him into soap. No,
if I get to choose, I think this is how I'd want to go out, because it means that then at least two people have wanted to date me.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Anyway, so Foster also reports seeing a deceased former prison officer, Sergeant Shoemaker, standing in Clifton's office, and then he just disappears. He'd been dead for a year. Like, so that sucks, man. Like, I'm sure that was not a place that he would want to be.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Maybe it's just, I don't know. Maybe people get stuck
just
places.
Get stuck.
Or maybe like if a place has so many ghosts and energy, it's just like you are just bound.
You get sucked back in.
Yeah, you get sucked back in. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe we'll find out. Maybe we won't. Let's move on and talk about cell number 3. Notorious for strange events, Charles Marquez was held there and he was found in the morning, very badly beaten, scratched up and everything. But he's like, wasn't any of the cops,
which
I mean, you'd think make something up at least or try to rationalize. But no, it's like, no, it wasn't any of them. It was an invisible thing. Couldn't tell you anything about, you know, who it was. They said every criminal who was put in there met pretty much a similar fate. And so later it's discovered that three murderers were put in there and they all essentially killed each other, like a battle royale kind of thing.
Great idea.
Yeah, who came up with this idea?
I don't know. It was crowded.
Do we know anything about these people? Something you just found?
That's all they said.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a story that the cops were passing on to the reporter who, you know, may have taken some dramatic license with the story, but on the other hand, it's if it didn't happen, it should have happened.
It should have
happened.
So something like that definitely happened.
To explain cell number 3.
Yes,
right,
of course.
Right.
And the prison's finally torn down in 1937. And like you had a nice visual about like dust forming around like invisible outlines of people,
that's
you know.
That's what they said.
Yeah, the legend has
that's
it.
That's what they claimed.
No, that's a very dramatic way to end that section. Let's move on to what might possibly be... my favorite story from New Orleans so far. I don't know if favorite's the right word. It is the right word, but, and I want to talk.
It's probably my favorite. It's my favorite location.
Okay. And, you know, and
just we'll, because
we'll go through
it
your,
just is.
Let's go through your research yeah. part at the end of it. I want, okay. I just want to talk about this.
Yeah.
So
well, that's why I saved that to the end.
Yes.
I didn't want to ruin, you know.
And, oh no. Oh, if you,
I didn't want to ruin a good story with facts.
And know? I, if you look at my notes, it's all caps and I'm pissed. And I was like, are you kidding me? But because I read what you said, but then it didn't click to me until I got to the end. So I love this quote. You said, it's a story that has a little of everything. Sex, pirates, foreign intrigue, blood pouring into the street, hacked off limbs, brutal revenge. And did I mention sex? So like already you have my attention, right? So this Sultan's Palace, it's a mansion built by Dr. Joseph Garday at the corner of Orleans and Dauphine Street in 1836. It's eventually sold to Jean-Baptiste Lepre. I'm trying to work on the French pronunciation guy that left this comment. Thank you. Who added the cast iron grill work to the balconies, which, you know, is very famous. And I actually Googled a picture of this to see if I had recognized this
we've
place.
Seen it.
I knew that we walked by it, but I was like, I didn't.
We saw it.
I didn't really think anything of it.
I didn't remember it.
I didn't know that this great story. So he eventually falls on hard times, eventually forced to rent out his wonderful home in 1878. So his tenant, a mysterious Turk who claimed to be a deposed sultan. So this all started when a warship comes in at night and a wealthy Asian man asks if the property might be available for lease. Turns out the man was not a sultan, but the brother of one who had fled with his brother's wife, all his belongings, an entourage, security, and a harem. Is that harem? How do you?
Harem.
Harem. Yeah, okay. Which is very interesting. It's very like, it reminds me of like the like Helen of Troy kind of
well,
thing.
Well, this is like
a
combination.
Different.
This story or this guy.
Yeah.
This guy and his entourage is like a perfect stereotype of every Arabic, Turkish,
yes,
Oriental, you know, thing that no one understood at the time.
Sure.
He's like perfect combination of all those things. None of it makes sense because there isn't a single thing. I mean, it's like everything. Everything you think of from, right, you know, the mystical Orient, you know,
right,
it's all in this one guy, which should right there, everyone
be a red
should
flag.
Already be suspicious.
Yes. So Lepre had to move himself and his family out while the quote unquote Sultan turned his house into an Eastern pleasure palace, which sounds dope. But he really goes all out decking this place out. So he said the neighbors could hear the women that were in there but could never see them. Very mysterious.
Right, because they were in the harem. And
right.
So they were guarded by
a fortress,
you know,
and the guards.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So you know, no one else was supposed to mess with, you know, the harem.
Right,
so.
Right. Well, he should have taken his own advice, apparently. But so one night, a terrible storm came into the city, and with it, an unfamiliar ship. That next morning, neighbors passing by the mansion noticed the trickles of blood were running out from under the iron gates, which is weird, because, you know, they usually had armed guards with curly swords and not trickles of blood. They decided to force it open. They find three dead servants in the courtyard, and this paragraph got me going. Okay, so a massacre had occurred at the house. Blood splattered the floor and walls. Headless bodies and amputated limbs were scattered about, all of them butchered by sword or axe. No room without a horrific scene. The bodies and limbs were flung about, mutilated and burned in such a way that it was impossible to tell which body part belonged to what person. No exact count of the dead was ever determined. Metal as hell, and I love it. Many were subjected to sexual assaults, the details of which we don't even know, and I don't really want to talk about, but I did want to mention, is it weird that, like, that the paragraph above, I loved it. It's so brutal. Decapitations, blood on the walls, great. Anytime you even mention, like, a minor sexual assault, I'm like, can we just not? Like, yeah. I don't get why. Why is that so taboo? And the other stuff, I'm like, yes, let's go.
I don't know.
It just makes me feel uncomfortable. But so we won't talk about that. But the Sultan's mutilated bodies found in the garden where he'd been buried alive, where he choked on mouthfuls of dirt, which sounds like an easy way to go compared to everybody else. Over his hasty grave, a letter had been left bearing an inscription in Arabic that read, "The justice of heaven is satisfied, and the date tree shall grow on the traitor's tomb." It is said that a tall tree did grow on the spot, and it was locally known as the Tree of Death. So my first note after this was, in all caps, I want to see the Tree of Death. And then my next note after this was, so wait, so this might not even have happened? Okay, what do we know? You can only find some stuff in books.
Yeah,
what do you
that's
think?
That's the thing.
What do you think?
You know, it's, I mean, the story, as I said in this monologue, the story had to have gotten started for some reason.
Right.
So, I mean, there has to be something to it. And like I said, the first mention I ever found of it was in the book that History of Louisiana book, which was written in 1867, which is kind of either, depends on the version of the legend you hear, is either before or after this actually happened.
Okay.
But it did say that there was a sultan who was murdered, but he was, it never goes into any kind of detail. There was no slaughter or anything like that. But I did like the quote from that book where the guy said that the ship was filled with a body of men who wore the scowling appearance of malefactors and ministers of blood.
Yeah.
I thought, and then I said, that would make a great band name. And it would, wouldn't it?
Yeah, hell yeah.
I don't even know if you need the malefactors, just ministers of blood.
Well, I think then they have the album Morbid Curious.
Oh, yeah, right. 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 And you know, it would be those guys that do the, you know, that, and you can't understand what
I
they
have
say.
Gigabytes of that.
Yeah, exactly. So, but then I found it again in Legends of Louisiana, which is about as accurate as, well, the funny thing is that, you know, that Levine, that Gene Levine book that I always talk about, how inaccurate that Ghost Stories in New Orleans book is.
Oh, yeah.
It's not even in there.
Oh, so it's that bad.
It's that bad.
Damn.
But I found it in this book, and it's basically the same story, but it's not as graphic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a lot of people killed. So, but there's no mention of it in any newspapers. There's nothing in police reports. There's no official record that their massacre ever took place at that house.
Maybe they were so rich they covered it all.
I don't know, man. There's something I smells about this story. I know. And so do I, because I love this. I mean, there's just something cool about
it's
this
a great,
story.
It's a great story. Story. Yeah.
And it's such a cool New Orleans story, but there's so many red flags throughout the entire story that makes you wonder if there's anything true about it at all. But
yeah.
It's still a cool story. And then there are ghost stories attached to the building.
Yes.
You know, so maybe they don't have anything to do with people being mutilated and beheaded, but they're good stories.
Right.
You know? And so we know the building's haunted, and maybe it's one of those things where, you know, the story just sort of grew over time. So, you know, like the Myrtles Plantation, mm-hmm. we feel the need to add more things to make the story better, because just seeing a man in oriental robes is really not that interesting.
Not doing
but
it.
We did find there was a story from 1867 about a sultan that was murdered there. So, you know, what if this sultan had brought all these? So you see how it grows.
Yep.
And I think that, and New Orleans is notorious for that too. As we talked about, I mean, that was our two-part Madame Lavery story.
Yes.
Where, you know, that stuff was so blown out of proportion. Not that she wasn't, you know, horrible, a horrible, horrible person, but, you know, the things that she supposedly did, as if, you know, starving your slaves wasn't bad enough, you had to experiment on them too,
right.
You know? So this is kind of the same kind of thing. So somebody was probably murdered here, but let's talk about his harem, and let's
yes.
make it really a big story, and that's probably what happened. But
yeah.
It doesn't change the fact that for, you know, 150 years, people have talked about the place being haunted.
Mm-hmm.
They seem pretty reliable. I mean, these are people who don't have any reason to make this stuff up.
Yeah.
I mean, what good does it do them to talk about this? I mean, sure, they got mentioned in the newspaper, but, you know, the one woman was, you know, at the time she was just starting her career, but she ended up becoming like internationally famous. So she really didn't need a ghost story, you know, that she told in the newspaper when she was just starting out as a dancer.
Is that,
you know,
Poston?
Virgie Poston.
Poston.
Her,
okay.
Gypsy was the name she used on stage, Gypsy uh-huh. Poston. So she really gotcha. Became well known, but and at the time she wasn't, but why would she need to make that up?
Right.
You know, there's no reason.
Well, that's an interesting story too, because like you said, she claimed to have been startled by a man in oriental costume, but she didn't know about the legends. Eventually sees him standing at the end of her bed, and she, this goes on for a little bit, she abandons everything the next day. But this is what's interesting to me, because this was that impactful for her. It's much like the exorcism story we talked about in St. Louis, where it's like, okay, maybe this isn't exactly what happened, but this guy was going from train to St. Louis back to his job and back and
right.
forth, and they moved his whole family across the country. Like, these people at least believe something's
right.
going on.
Something happened.
Yeah,
right.
Like she is scared
it was
enough
for her to bail.
Yeah, bail, leave all of her shit. And then she and one of her friends stop by to get some things. They hear his blood curdling scream just a few feet away from them. And she, I like how you mentioned, like, she's like, yeah, we laugh about it now, but like, it was pretty terrifying, you know?
Yeah.
Something's going on. I mean, it's at least real to them. And
if
nothing else, even if it's just in their heads, it's very real. It's still real enough because it's in their heads. So 1966, the house was purchased by Jean D'Amico, her husband Frank, and a partner who converted it into luxury apartments. Jean. Okay.
Yeah.
So all these French things. I'm trying to pronounce it right.
Yeah, and then actually she's just Jean, so we didn't even have to go fancy on her.
So
yeah.
Jean also sees a figure watching her sleep, and she even tries to like blink a couple times and be like, is this really happening? It's now owned by Nina Nevins. Is that it?
Yeah, Nina Nevins.
Nina Nevins, and divided into six apartments. She said, you know, stuff still goes missing, but for the most part, hauntings seemed to have kind of dissipated and calmed down. And that's something that seems like we find after a while that's just kind of dissipates and things calm down. So all's well that ends well. I guess. All right. Well, it's now time for our Ghost Rider segment. If you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. So our first email comes to us from Sarah. She says, "Hey, guys, I've been really enjoying the New Orleans season. Wanted to share with you the spooky image I captured in January 2013 when we went on a ghost tour in New Orleans with a stop at St. Louis Cemetery No. 1. I didn't notice this in the picture until 4 or 5 years later. At the end of the row of tombs on the left, it almost looks like a hooded figure stepping into view. Maybe it's Marie Laveau, maybe not. I've included the original and a close-up. To be fair, there were others on the tour with us, and this was the part where we were able to explore a little on our own. Could be another tourist. Let me know what you think." So I'll put the pictures in the show notes somewhere. People can check it out. I looked at it this morning. Definitely looks like something's leaning over.
Oh, yeah?
Who knows? It's a haunted cemetery, but I also really appreciate her being like, to be fair, it could just be this. Like, so thank you so much for listening. And, I hope you had a good time on that tour. This next one comes to us from Terry Lane. It says, "This podcast is fantastic. Enjoy listening to the storytelling and the, quote, hilarious jokes and awesome sarcasm of Cody." Says, "I did that just for you, Cody. Thank you so much. Based on the commentary for the first episode in season 4, I also found you guys from listening to Astonishing Legends episodes on Villisca murders. And Troy, I appreciate all your work on those 17 episodes." All was in all caps. "I still have to go back to seasons 1 and 2. You don't really have to, but you can if you want.
Season 2 was really good.
Yeah, that's
season 1,
no, you should go check it out. Just
some bad audio
get
in
good,
season
get
2.
Get a good
but
pair
it
of
was,
heads. Phones.
Yeah, right.
Said, "But I'll listen to all of them. Keep up the excellent work and the simply fabulous sarcasm. If no one gets, I do. It's near and dear to my ears." So she knows exactly how to get near and dear to my heart. I really appreciate it. So thank you so much for that. Again, AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com.
All right. Well, I think that we will wrap up this episode. So guys, thanks for listening. Thanks for the comments. Thanks for the emails. Thanks for sharing things. Thanks for really sticking with us during this pandemic, especially with American Hauntings itself. You guys, we owe you a great debt of gratitude for really keeping things afloat for us without having any tours or events or anything that we could do. You guys coming through has been really awesome, and we really, really appreciate it. Take advantage while you still can. We've still got that 20% off deal with the free book bag. Just use the promo code SPOOKY. Don't forget, we've got some live stream things coming up. Just go to the AmericanHauntings.net or just go to my Facebook page, the author page, and you'll find all the up-to-date information there. And until then, we'll see you next time.
Yeah, I'm having a lot of trouble reading today, so I think I'm just going to call this one. Obviously, I've been slurring and stepping over my words. But in this episode of the American Hauntings Podcast, is written by Troy Taylor and is produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. In each bi-weekly episode, we try to combine history, folklore, legend, imagination, and the truth to reveal more about America's most haunted places, strange tales, and unexplained events. You can find the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows, and at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, where we also have show notes, more info about the episodes, and links to more from American Hauntings. Because American Hauntings isn't just a podcast.
It's literally books, tours, events, and more.
And our main website is AmericanHauntings.net. And if you want even more from us, you can be a supporter of the podcast on Patreon. You can get bonus episodes of the show, t-shirts, discounts, great stuff in the mail, and more. Thanks to our supporters, we have upgraded our equipment for
the
show.
We've also just caught up
with continued help from you.
We were running a little
behind. Dedicate more time and resources to creating even more shows in the future. Take a minute and check it out. We think you'll like what you find at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. Be sure to get in touch if you have any comments about the show, suggestions, reviews, jokes, or just want to tell us what you really think of us. We're reachable via email, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, a bunch of other bullshit, and by carrier pigeon.
Oh, yeah.
Until next time, goodbye.
Well, so long.
See you later.
Cool.
I don't know. I've drank way more than this, but I don't know if I haven't read out loud in a while.
I know. Well, we're like, probably just out of practice.
I think we are out of practice. I was like stumbling over these
emails. Really, I got to be honest with you. I don't have there isn't a shit ton of mistakes in this
episode. Oh, really?
Episode that I did.